From downtown Milwaukee, welcome to Money Talk with Bob Landis. Each week, professional advisors from Landis & Company Investments discuss the latest financial developments, offering timely insight and long-term perspective.
This is Money Talk for December 18th, 2020. While the Packers host the Carolina Panthers this Saturday night at Lambeau, and the Bucks start playing for real this Wednesday in Boston. Let's start this podcast with some financial news. Taking everything into account, Santa's annual salary for this year should be around $157,000. Now, Giannis, the Greek freak, just signed a five-year, $250 million contract. Doing some quick math, Giannis could fund Santa for the next 1,600 years. Speaking of Santa, the Canadian Transportation Department has officially renewed Santa's pilot's license. That means when he's not delivering toys, he can double as a traffic reporter for your local TV stations. New Jersey, the home of Bruce Springsteen, swamps and landfills, now has an official state microorganism. That should do wonders for tourism. A British woman was complaining about vision problems. Well, it didn't take long for the optometrist to figure out the problem. She had 27 contact lenses stuck in one eye.
Oh, goodness.
How is that even possible? And a woman from Sedona, Arizona, the metaphysical center of the universe, claims Sedona is home to 10 hybrid children, part human, part alien, kind of like a Toyota Prius. And finally, try not to laugh at this, but it's hard not to. A Japanese man died when his giant pornography collection fell on him. Okay, you didn't laugh. Good.
Stuff will kill you.
On the podcast today, we have Brian Kilb, Art Rothschild, Joel Driesing, and wrapping up the week, here's Kyle Tedding.
Well, thanks for that, Max. A pretty good week overall for markets. You look at the NASDAQ up 3.1% this week, 378 points. The S&P 500 up 1.3% or 46 points. And the Dow Jones Industrial Average down 116 points today, but up 0.5% for the week to close at the bell at 30,187. So just a little below record highs for the Dow, a little bit below record highs for the S&P and the NASDAQ as well. It's, again, overall a pretty good week, though, for stocks for the year. With really a little more than, 8 days left to go here, eight trading days left to go, a pretty stellar year. The Dow up 8.2% when you factor in dividends, the S&P 500 up almost 17%, up 16.9%, and the NASDAQ up 43.4%. Any way you look at those numbers, it's been a stellar year for stocks, and certainly plenty for us to be happy about as we, now a week away from the holiday season. Worth mentioning, the 10-year Treasury moved a little bit higher this week. It's been pretty range-bound over the last, the better part of the last month now, finishing at the bell today at 0.95%. So not able to cross that 1% threshold just yet. And maybe some reasons to think why that might persist for a while we can get into today. But overall, encouraging sign that the 10-year Treasury has been able to hang out near that 1% level for quite a while now. I think as we look at, kind of the most important stuff that happened this week, I think the number one thing to talk about is some of the economic indicators, in particular, just given that we're talking about a Christmas shopping season and a Black Friday, which usually leads into, for a lot of businesses, what becomes, the make or break part of their year. And we got some pretty disappointing numbers on retail sales for the month of November, Joel.
Yeah, Kyle, that's right. The good news is that retail spending is now back up before, where it was before the pandemic. So we're, overall, retail sales are still doing pretty well. But the numbers that came out this week on Wednesday, showed that retail spending was down for the second month in a row. And as you said, something like a quarter of all retail sales, for many retailers, a lot more so, come from this quarter of the year. You can look at it in different ways. First of all, we look at these numbers because, as we always point out, consumer spending is like two-thirds of our economic activity. So retail spending is a good sign of you know, how the economy is doing. But I mean, there are reasons why people wouldn't spend. I mean, part of it could be psychological. You think, I don't feel real good about my job or you know, my prospects, and I don't feel like spending right now. I don't feel that I can afford to do that. We've seen more numbers about, you know, consumer outlook declining. Another part of it is just logistical. You've pointed out on the podcast before that, you know, it's hard to spend money sometimes, you know, and if you look, so there are 13 different categories for retail spending, 10 of them declined in November. One that has gone up though, since the pandemic, is online, because you can spend money there. You can, you know, you can find your way over to all those online vendors and they'll take your money. But one category, and I put a chart of this on the podcast on our website, is looking at bars and restaurants. Well, you know, there's a case where, and we're, you know, seeing this now more as COVID is you know, we're seeing more cases of COVID, that more places are shutting down and restricting service. So there are winners and losers in that. But overall, retail sales are up, but from the pandemic. But you know, as we say, it's losing some steam. Part of it is practical too. Part of it is, you know, people have lost jobs. People have lost incomes. Some people have lost benefits from, you know, unemployment and so on. There's a lot of concern about, you know, trying to restock some of the benefits that Congress sent out earlier in the year, and because people spent that money, that really helped the economy go back then.
And Joel, in the middle of all this, we've got you know, discussions about government spending now coming to a head tonight. If we don't reach a deal or at least an extension of the current budget, then we potentially are shutting down the government at least for a little while. And, you know, representatives have tied that deal to potentially more stimulus measures. And so that's one thing that could help retail sales. But I think the other thing that, you know, certainly we've been discussing for a while is that this is a week in which we saw the first frontline workers receive vaccinations. And so you know, you've heard Dr. Fauci say this week that if we can get to a point, maybe by the second half of next year, where we've got enough people vaccinated, and especially the vulnerable populations, the populations most likely to be exposed or most likely to be severely ill, we can begin to talk about what the new normal for our economy looks like. And so, you know, I think the retail sales data that we're talking about certainly point to an economy that's been hit hard by the pandemic, an economy that for large chunks of November was experiencing significant increases in cases that, even if bars and restaurants were open, maybe kept people out of those bars and restaurants because they hoped to see family for Thanksgiving or because they just didn't want to risk it. They maybe weren't willing to spend in those places that the way they were earlier on, you know, say late summer. So, you know, I think a lot of moving pieces to that one, a lot of reasons to believe that things can get better, but a ways to go. The other one, you know, from the economic data that, you know, has stood out to me is just the continued changing trends in the housing data, in particular, some strong prices, in particular, you know, strong sales overall considering, but a lot of noise in that data, a lot of, you know, I think differences between areas. And we learned some more this week.
That's right, Kyle. Yeah, that is a really volatile category to look at. But again, the pandemic is really affecting it. People are, you know, wanting to or having to stay home more, hunker down more, and they want to be more comfortable. So they're you know, building offices or you know, taking that spare bedroom in the basement and making it into a workspace, or buying another house, or moving from a populated area to a more rural area because they're working remotely and it doesn't really matter where they are anyway. So we've seen a lot of that happen, and it's a supply and demand thing. For a couple of years now, the National Association of Realtors was complaining that there wasn't enough inventory, that people wanted to buy houses, especially with low interest rates. another thing that the pandemic is, I mean, you know, we heard from the Fed this week that they're still going to keep interest rates low. So, you know, that's good for home buyers. But there wasn't a lot of, you know, enough housing stock out there. So the prices kept going up. So, you know, increasingly we're hearing that it's difficult for first time home buyers to find a place, or you know, people on the lower end or in the middle to find a place because the prices are getting bumped up so much. We had numbers this week from the Commerce Department on building permits and housing starts. Both of those are back at you know, levels that they were before the last recession, you know, 2006, 2007. So that's one bright spot in the economy right now is housing. And that, you know, is a smaller part of the economy, but it also, you know, entails a lot of jobs. It also entails a lot of spending that, you know, takes place besides buying a house. All the, you know, Jason, who's engineering the podcast today, just bought his first house. And I mean, he can probably attest that, you know, just sort of paying the down payment wasn't it. I mean, he's probably running to Home Depot or whatever, you know, every day. So, but that's a bright spot right now is housing.
It does seem, Joel, that being a homeowner is never ending. Brian and I have had many conversations about his multiple trips to the hardware store to solve even just a fairly simple problem, either because we just forgot that extra thing we needed to fix it or because that thing we thought we needed wasn't really it.
Well, that's how we measure the complexity of the task at hand is how many hardware store trips it takes, right? Like that was in my house. That was a three tripper, you know? So, but I do think when you kind of consider all these thoughts, you guys, the effect of current economic data, in this case, maybe retail sales, or you kick about the idea of whether we run out of funding for a week or two or a day or two or whatever. I think the time period in which you give some thought to these things really matters. And I think what the vaccinations for COVID, you know, Kyle, whether it takes to midsummer, or I just read an article where a doctor suggested if we could get to all the at-risk people right away, we could kind of be free to move about the cabin as early as kind of January or February, you know. But the fact that we're debating whether that's earlier or later is somewhat irrelevant to the fact that we're not debating whether or not it's going to happen anymore. And so I think when you look at businesses throughout the country, or whether you're looking at how people spend their money, there's a big difference between wondering if you're going to hang on till it ends and having an idea that it's going to end and you got to plan to get there. And I actually think some of the softness in these last couple of months is more of a sign that we know there's an end. And we're doing our best to kind of bolster our own financial circumstances to get through things because we know we're coming out the other end. So there's a little bit of a danger, I think, in getting too pessimistic over the next couple of months because there's help around the, you know, around the corner. And I think, you know, hopefully people will come out of this thing ready to do some buying and get back to normal.
If I may, it's important to note that these various economic statistics can be classified as either lagging indicators, leading indicators, or coincident indicators. And so what Brian just, you know, mentioned and what Joel just went over, these are pretty much coincident indicators. We're talking about what's going on right now. They're not telling us about anything with respect to the future. And Brian's comments, I couldn't agree with you more. Looking forward to a year from now, what are we going to be seeing? We're going to be seeing a year. And I literally deliberately went out that far. And that's because the stock market is the single most significant leading indicator I think we have. And that's reflecting that optimism that you just alluded to. So I would think the stock market's probably right in this case, at least knock on wood. I'm hopeful that it is.
Well, and when we upped our, but the government upped its forecast for growth for next year, right? 4% to 4.2%. So you're like, well, okay, whatever is happening in the next few weeks or the next couple of months, if you take a step back and you look at next year as a whole, we've become more optimistic since that last report was written. So yeah, I think it's going to sound maybe even feel worse for a month or two. But you know, good news today, the second vaccine approved and, you know, the cavalry is on its way. So we can see an end in sight. And now our discussion is how do we get from this point to that point? And I think that's a very different conversation than, you know, what's going to happen in the meantime. So I'm looking forward to that and seeing how it plays out.
Yeah, such a good point, Brian. I think as we look at some of the other news from this week, Joel, you mentioned it earlier, the Fed meeting You know, I want to stress, of course, that the Federal Reserve controls short-term interest rates. They control some of the bond buying programs that are out there that have been accommodative to the economy more broadly. And by all accounts, Fed Chair Jerome Powell is intending to remain accommodative, is intending for the Fed to remain accommodative, which should, for the short term, keep interest rates fairly low. It also is indicative of exactly what they said, which is that inflation isn't going to be a concern for a while. They're seeing the deflationary pressures around the world rather than concerns about inflation. And so as we look at kind of the near-term outlook, I think inflation maybe isn't one of the primary concerns. Longer term, Art, you mentioned kind of the difference between these coincident or lagging indicators and this idea of leading indicators. And one of the things that we can look at beyond stock markets alone is what is the difference between long-term rates and short-term interest rates? And what does that tell us about the direction we're headed? You know, we often explain it as the steepness of the yield curve. If you think of a mountain chart where the left hand is yields on the short-term side of the bond market and the right-hand side is yields on the long-term side, the taller that mountain is on the right-hand side relative to the left-hand side, or more importantly, the higher long-term rates are relative to short-term rates, the more the expectation is that we're going to see a reacceleration of growth at some point. And Art, what we've seen is that while short-term rates remain low, the rates on the longer-term side of the curve have moved up as the stock market moved up. I think confirming for many that the expectation is, you know, as Brian rightfully points out, that maybe the next couple of months aren't what we should be looking at, but that as we get past the bad data that we all expect in the next couple of months, things might reaccelerate.
I'd like to comment on that Fed comment. The Federal Reserve, this was to me about the most bullish federal commentary I've ever seen. We all know that they're going to keep interest rates, short-term rates low for as long as possible, but it's sort of like they're doubling down. This is like quantitative easing on steroids. So they're suggesting they want to avoid the kind of problems that Bernanke had way back when coming out of the Great Recession. And so they're expecting, as we are expecting, at least I'm expecting, a spike in prices when, you know, we all get to book our plane tickets to anywhere, you know, in the not too distant future. But the fact that they're even commenting on that and suggesting that that doesn't mean that inflation is back permanently in a very malignant way, but the fact that they recognize that and suggest they're going to keep interest rates low and continue to buy bonds would suggest to me that even though the long-term rates have gone up to close to 1%, maybe close to 1.25% by 1.5% by the end of next year, that's reasonable. It's not a huge spike, and they're going to make sure that we have a nice takeoff, you know, and start soaring at a reasonable level, and they're not going to cause any problems. So they're out of the way, man. This could be a great time for investors to continue to invest. That's my view. I'm feeling pretty good about it.
Yeah, I think the cautionary note to that would be, you know, I've been around long enough, Arthur, you've been around long enough. About the time everybody starts to feel the same way about something is about the time I start to get a little bit nervous, you know. And I understand all the rightful arguments for more deflationary pressure. I understand that the Fed is committed both psychologically and in practice to doing what they can to get things where they need to be. But, you know, I think if everybody's thinking one way and we get a little bit too confident somewhere down the road, you know, that might be the time where we need to be a little bit careful and be, you know, not to build your portfolio in a way that it doesn't allow for the fact that interest rates could rise or inflation could rise and just continue to have an answer in your portfolio, because these things do become surprising in terms of how they time out sometimes.
Brian, it is so amazing how it seems to come back to balance in every one of these conversations because, you know, I think you're spot on there that the challenge is if we all are confident in what's going to happen, we don't have to miss by much for it to be a pretty big deal for what happens with our investments, right? If we all have kind of diverse opinions on what we think the outcome is going to be, you can miss by a little here and there, and it probably isn't all that big a deal. But if everybody's drop dead certain that inflation's not going to be a problem, and we see even a little bit, maybe it's because demand begins to outstrip supply more than we expected. And Art's that's kind of your point on, okay, those airline tickets, if we've cut all these flights and all of a sudden people start buying up tickets because they're confident, those airline prices spike or whatever it is spikes because we just don't have the supply, that can lead to a little bit of inflation. But the reminder here for balanced investors is that one of the best tools you have for inflation is stocks. It's why you've got that piece of your portfolio. Those underlying companies have the ability to raise their prices. If airline prices go up, who does that benefit? It benefits the very airlines that you'd be buying as part of your stock portfolio. And so I think the challenge here is that we've been so focused on growth for so long that in an environment in which inflation or even, you know, lack of inflation, but just some stronger economic growth comes about, it's no longer strictly about can you grow or not. It becomes how well can you grow? Is that quality earnings growth or is it just simply growth at any cost? And what we've seen, I think, with a lot of the growth names out there is that they're under some pressure now, whether it's regulatory, whether it's proving that they can consistently post earnings numbers. And if we do see this environment that we expect, again, whether it's months from now or quarters from now or beyond, it becomes increasingly important in the stock piece of your portfolio to not just focus on those growth names anymore. That means that some of the value names that we have ignored for far too long come back into favor. It also means, I think most importantly, that, you know, as I said, quality of earnings is the thing that really matters.
You know, Kyle, I think that allows me to make a point that I kind of like to bring up every once in a while. When you talk about building balanced portfolios, and again, there's any number of ways to show how important that philosophy was in a year like this when things were so erratic and so unpredictable. But building balanced portfolios doesn't imply a passivity. You know, it's not like you build a balanced portfolio and you don't do anything. You're still active within that portfolio. You're talking about some of these growth stocks. We've had a whole bunch of conversations about value versus growth in the last year. You know, we're having conversations about should we be overseas more or less, or bigger or smaller companies. You know, on the bond side, there's always, you know, maturity conversations and credit quality conversations. And there are plenty of things to do and to be active in your portfolio while maintaining that balance. And sometimes I think people confuse the idea of balance with just doing something and sitting on it through a period of time. And that's not what we're implying here.
Yeah, I think that's a critical point that you can have a 60-40 portfolio every day, but that 60-40 portfolio, that's a tough one to get out.
Yeah.
That 60-40 portfolio looks very different at the start of this year than it is going to at the end of this year, simply because the opportunity set has changed. So yeah, I think that's definitely the right way to think about this.
Exactly what I'm saying. Yeah, thank you.
I think the one other thing to point out this week is it was looking like it was going to be a pretty crazy Friday. We have quadruple witching happening today, which while a bit out there in terms of what it means for the everyday investor, it can add to volatility. And then we have a pretty big change to the S&P 500 coming on Monday. And so a lot of repositioning as Tesla becomes a fairly major component of the 500 stock index. And I think, you know, a lot of investors wondering, you know, what that means for their portfolios now that Tesla's gotten a little more respect. Art, I know that, you know, active managers have a very different view of what it means for something to be in or out of the S&P 500 index. Why don't you, you know, let investors know maybe what that means for them now that Tesla's a part of the index, but more importantly, why it might not be as big of a deal for, you know, the individuals.
Kyle, yeah, this inclusion of Tesla, which they first passed on months ago, and then they decided to put it in, I think it's the largest company that's ever been included in the S&P 500 at some point, you know, after it's already grown, I guess that's the way you'd put it. The interesting thing about Tesla is it's only going to be 1.5% of the S&P 500, but even more interesting, the earnings contribution is only 0.2% is the number I've seen. And the amazing thing to me about Tesla is that I wouldn't have touched this stock with a 10-foot pole. 2 years ago, it was on the brink of bankruptcy. And at least so they were saying, it's up, it's 600% or something like that in 2 years. Don't hold me to the exact figures. But what it means now for the individual investor is you don't have to just be a sophisticated research team in a major investment house to be buying this stock because you really do believe it has future potential. We're all going to own it. one way or another in our portfolio somewhere. If somebody's got an index, it's there. So I don't think your individual investor should take time to even think about Tesla. I think you should accept the fact you're going to have it somewhere if you don't already. But I do think it speaks volumes about something, Kyle, that you've been talking about forever. It's changes in paradigms. And that this is a company that's being included, and you've mentioned it before, not because of its prior earnings, because of its potential for changing look at technology and what that company will be in the future, which to me just boggles the mind. You understand it much more than I do. So your average investor, don't worry about it. You've got it one way or another, and you're going to have it. And I think it'll support the stock for some time to come.
Yeah, I think the worrisome part of that to me is if you took a company like Tesla that was trading rich, you know, and let's just all agree that it's an expensive company relative to our earnings expectations. Now, again, you know, how far out do you want to go and how much earnings growth do you want to project? But at least for now, you know, a company that's grown sevenfold in a short amount of time is pretty pricey. Now you're going to get billions of dollars of more purchases of that stock by way of being included in an index, which makes it even more a highly valued proposition. I think at some point in time, you know, when these things happen, doesn't somebody at some point in time recognize that it may be a bit pricey and put some pressure on, some selling pressure on it? So I'm not sure that this isn't something maybe that could trigger this thing going the other direction and maybe coming back to a more reasonable price in the context of today's valuations. You know, you never know with these things, but that would be something I'd pay attention to.
And Art, you had a bit of a throwaway comment, which is that many of our investors probably already held Tesla. But I think that's a point that maybe gets missed in a lot of this, is that if you're investing in active management, and again, there's that word again, it means that you probably have some stuff that isn't in the S&P 500 because the portfolio manager for the mutual fund that you hold anticipated this 2 years ago, that at some point in time at the S&P 500 was going to have to include a business like Tesla. And we're using Tesla as the example here, but I think, you know, it speaks to what the ultimate goal of indexes are, right? The S&P is designed to be a list of the 500 most relevant companies traded here in the U.S. And yeah, there's a lot of rules-based construction that gets into how we do that. And that's a conversation for a whole nother day. But ultimately, it means that something like the S&P 500 can grow faster than the economy broadly, something like an index that cares about the businesses it puts into it. And this is, again, before we even look at active management, this is just the index. We can get to a point where the S&P can outgrow GDP or outgrow the U.S. more broadly, simply because it's including businesses that are relevant to what's happening today, what's happening tomorrow. So I think that, you know, the bigger picture here for investors is that by focusing on what matters rather than simply looking at, yeah, the U.S. economy, you know, growth has slowed decade by decade over the last 40 or 50 years. Yeah, that's true. But that doesn't mean that it's slowed everywhere. And so there are still those opportunities for growth that I think are going to be critical for investor success when we look at, again, not month to month, quarter to quarter, but when we look out 5, 10 and beyond years. Well, thanks for listening. As always, we enjoy doing the show for you. We'll talk to you again next week.
Thank you for listening to Money Talk with Bob Landis. If you have a financial question you want answered on next week's show, email it to moneytalk@landis.com. To keep informed throughout the week, visit our Money Talk page at landis.com.